So is it working?
No.
Well, it's recording.
Oh, now it's going. Okay.
Okay. So I'll introduce you.
Okay.
So, everyone, this is Jay Ripple. Are you a native Chatham person?
I grew up in East Chatham, West Lebanon.
Okay.
Kind of,
yeah. A person from around these parts,
yeah,
who is recently back from Afghanistan, who's here to tell us about it. So go right ahead, Jay.
Thanks, everybody, for coming tonight. My name is Master Sergeant Jay Ripple in the U.S. Army Reserve. I've got 28 years in. This was my second tour in Afghanistan. I finished that in April of this year. We went over in May of 2010. And my first tour was from June 2003 until April 2004. So I had about 6 years in between tours. And so I'm not really an expert on Afghanistan, but I've seen a few things and done a few things over there that might make an interesting story. And feel free at any time to ask any questions that might make it easier. But my job in the Army now is I'm a medic slash LPN, even though I'm a registered nurse in civilian world and I work in emergency rooms. I went to Afghanistan both times as a medic, with most recently with the 344th Combat Support Hospital from Fort Dix, New Jersey. And there were about 50 of us who went, 47, 50, that went, and our job was to man a combat support hospital on the Afghanistan-Pakistan border. And we got over there right around the middle end of the big buildup of U.S. forces and push through the Afghanistan-Pakistan border area in the summer of 2010. Which meant we got to see a lot of trauma, a lot of injuries. The fortunate thing for us was, for our U.S. soldiers who were injured, we didn't hold them long. We would keep them 4 to 6 hours, or as soon as we could get them on a plane or helicopter to Bagram, they would go up to the Craig Joint Theater Hospital in Bagram, be stabilized there. We would do immediate life-saving surgery and then put them on a plane and send them up to Bagram. They would be stabilized there, and then the next flight out to Germany, they would move forward to Germany, and usually within 48 to 72 hours, they could be back at Walter Reed or at San Antonio at Brooke Army Medical Center. So it's a pretty quick turnaround time from the time folks get injured in Afghanistan till they get back to where they can be with their family and be taken care of and civilian hospitals or military hospitals in the United States. The hospitals in Afghanistan are rough. There aren't any civilian hospitals like we have here, and that's one of the biggest things. In my 28 years in the military, one of the things I've been to Central America a number of times, and Afghanistan twice. I did a tour in Germany back in the 80s and traveled throughout Europe. One of the things I've always felt is that every American ought to get a chance to see how the other side lives and get to a third world country and see. We would all appreciate a whole lot more what we have rather than, you know, expecting everything to be handed to us. I was on a mission in Guatemala in 1998, and we picked up a gentleman who had fallen and broken a hip 3 days before and laid in his little shack. In shock, near death from a fractured hip. And we would have been upset here if the ambulance wasn't there in 5 or 10 minutes. He waited 3 days for us to pick him up. We stabilized the hip. And then that night put him on a bus to take him 50 miles to Tegucigalpa, to the nearest hospital. Now 50 miles in Guatemala takes about 9 or 10 hours to get there. So if you can imagine a broken hip. And getting to Afghanistan, my first time over there in 03, I got to go to an Afghani hospital in the city of Khost. The building was kind of like that one right over there that has, see where the plywood is in the windows?
Yeah.
There was no windows, there was no plywood in the operating room. It was just an open window, and flies came in, mosquitoes came in. dust and dirt came in. So what's that lead to? Infection. Everybody the doctor in that hospital operated on wound up with an infection, and he would operate and try to and then try to bring them to us for antibiotics. You know, rules of engagement said we could only treat them if it was to save their life, limb, or eyesight. So until they got deathly ill, we had to say no. Wait until they're dying, and then you can bring them back to us. It really sucked. We don't do medicine like that here. Everybody gets treated, and but that was their Afghani medical system saying, "Hey, I need to send them to the Americans because I can't treat them anymore." And they didn't. They didn't have it. They didn't have the antibiotics we have. They didn't have. They just don't have the infrastructure in place to treat their sick and injured like we do here. Yeah.
I'm just curious, when you talked about being there in 2003 and then just your recent time there, did you see a big change in anything, in infrastructure and people's reaction?
There's been lots of money going in, but the real, now, I didn't get out to see. I know there were more hospitals, Afghani hospitals, being built. I did see a decline in the number of Afghani patients that we saw. Less anybody that was critical we saw.
Whether it was a civilian or not?
Yes. Yeah, we treated whoever they brought to the gate. And if it wasn't life, limb, or eyesight, we sent them back to the Afghani hospital. But we would usually lay an eyeball on them and make sure that, you know, and get them on their way to the civilian hospital. I didn't get out to the civilian hospital this time to see what they had in place. I was told there was a whole new Afghani hospital that the U.S. had built, our taxpayer dollars had built to try and get them to be a little more self-sufficient. But the underlying but there is everybody along the way, what if they gave $1 million to the coast provincial governor to build a hospital, by the time everybody took their cut of the bribes, the hospital actually maybe got $100,000. You know, and that's just the way things are over there. Everybody's got to get a payoff, even to the point that if we had Afghani guards working around the bases that we were on, if an Afghani wanted to come up for medical care, they had to slip the Afghani guard a bribe to get to up to the American gate. So everybody's, you know, it's kind of a crooked system, or it's a different system than what we have. And that's the way it is. If you want to build a highway, you've got to pay the bribes. You've got to pay people for protection. You've got to, you know, security, okay, but, you know, certain things didn't happen, you know, without the money being paid out first. I was about 6 miles from the Afghanistan-Pakistan border. And as everybody saw, where Osama bin Laden was caught was right in Pakistan. We frequently had, you know, and when I, oh, this was a big difference between 2003 and 04. In 03 and 04, everything was Al-Qaeda. And now they're saying Al-Qaeda has just about been decimated. There are less than a couple of hundred Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan now, and it's all Taliban. But the Taliban, they run across the border back and forth. There is no border to them. It's all one tribal area. The Afghanistan-Pakistan borders were, and I was telling Melissa earlier, they're designed by Anglos when the British occupied Afghanistan, that area of the world. It wasn't known as Afghanistan then, back in the early 1900s. And they named it Afghanistan and put that border there, and when they did, they put it right down the middle of a tribal area. Well, Afghanis all belong to tribes. They don't have a sense of national pride like we have, or, you know, their flag that they fly now is only about 4 years old. They've never had a national flag prior to about 4 years ago. So it's, you know, some of them really like the idea, but the tribe always comes first. So they're more loyal to their tribal warlord than the president of the country. Blank where I was going with that, but oh, so the Pakistan-Afghanistan border, you have Pashtuns that live on both sides. They're family members. They're all the same tribe. They cross back and forth with, you know, more frequently than we cross back and forth to Canada. And the Taliban would come across, rocket us or attack the FOB, and then run back across the Pakistan border. And there were a couple of times there were incidents where our helicopters would be chasing bad guys running back across the Pakistan border, and the Pakistan border guards knew who the guys were that were running back, and they would stand there and fire their AK-47s and their RPGs at the helicopters. The logical reaction for the helicopter pilot is, I'm going to defend myself. At one point, they blew up a border crossing guard or guard shack with five Pakistani border police in it, killed them. Government of Pakistan shut down the border crossing and said, okay, your trucks can't move through here anymore. They were really starving us out because it was a main supply route for bullets, beans, and, you know, whatever else went through. Guys weren't getting water. They weren't getting hot meals. They weren't getting, you know, resupplied. And it took a couple of weeks of negotiation before the Pakistanis would open that border up. The Pakistanis really have a vested interest in keeping the United States there. We're paying them billions of dollars every year, you know, to be part of the war on terror, but they're also supporting the Taliban because they're part of the same tribe. And as much money as we're putting into Afghanistan, it also benefits the Pakistanis. And Pakistan also has it figured out that if we're in Afghanistan, India isn't going to attack them with us so close and having so many troops. So, you know, they have a real vested interest for keeping the United States in that region. And as much as they're talking about a big withdrawal coming up, I see a long-term presence for the United States in Afghanistan. Some of the things we saw that you just don't see here in the United States. I've worked in trauma hospitals quite a bit here, but I never saw the number of children that I saw over there who would get blown up. Now, every time the U.S. has a friendly fire incident or hits a village and kills civilians, that makes big-time news. But when the Afghanis do it to their own people, we don't hear about it. And I saw children where, you know, casualties of war, but the Taliban had no accurate aiming system for their rockets and mortars. They would lean them up on a pile of rocks, set a timer on them so they'd be gone by the time they went off, or remote detonation with a cell phone. And they would set them up, point them in our direction. More frequently than not, they would fly over the FOB and hit the outlying villages right around us, which there were many. You know, three quarters of the way around the FOB, it was part of the city of Coast and little villages that belonged to that. And a number of times they would bring the injured. Sometimes there were whole families killed and sometimes you'd get one or two children. And one morning we got a little girl whose belly was blown wide open with a rocket from the Taliban. We couldn't go out to the gate and pick her up because we're still receiving incoming mortar rounds, but the infantry guys at the gate threw her in the back of a truck and brought her into us. When I went out to help them bring her in, half her stomach was blown away and she did not survive surgery. We had another little girl, and this was interesting, we noticed this a lot, that when family or young children came in, it wasn't a mom or dad that came to the hospital with them. It was an elder from the tribe. And they could give, you know, they always wanted the best of care done. But if we got, there were a number of times where we received injured male children and injured female children. And they always wanted us to work on the males first. That isn't the way we work. We treat the more severely injured one first. But the elder that came in with them always was pointing at the male and talking through the interpreters and telling us that we needed to take care of the males first. We had a little girl come in one night who was, they were sitting having tea, and as was a custom, and a mortar round came into the house. They had fired at a new fob that we had built up in the mountains somewhere, not too far from where we were, and the mortar missed the fob and hit this house directly, and it killed the mother, three children. They brought the little girl and her sister in, and after taking her to surgery, bringing her back out, you know, we had some bleeding in the belly and chest to stop. We stopped that. We took her to CAT scan. We did have a CAT scan in the hospital. It was one of three CAT scans in Afghanistan, and we had it in the hospital. We discovered a piece of shrapnel had transected the brainstem. It was a wound that was, she would not survive, and did not survive. We took her off of all life support, and we held her hand for 2 hours. Nobody else from her village came in with that one. Held her hand for 2 hours while she struggled to, and then finally just gave up and died. But the family members.
How do you deal with all that pain and suffering? How did you deal with all that? Is that training?
No.
Is there any way you can train for that?
No, there was no, you know, no psychological training or nothing ahead of time to prepare you for what we were going to see over there. And then, you know, support of the people that you're there with, and we just all leaned on each other, and we cried together, and we laughed together, and we played. You know, when we were busy and worked, we worked hard, and when it was time to let loose, we got wild. We'd have game nights, and we'd watch movies, and you know, get to know each other really well. And how are your kids doing? And you know, what are your kids doing these days? And you know, sometimes then just call home. That was a big difference this time around. From 2003 and 04, internet systems were a whole lot better, and Skype, I didn't have Skype in 03 and 04, and I could pick up the phone and dial directly to home on with an AT&T calling card, and in 03 and 04, I think we had four telephones on the fob, and I'd have to go through an operator in Afghanistan who would connect me to an operator back in the United States, and so you got one phone call a week. And this time I was able to call home almost daily. But
did you have to work on the enemy soldiers too?
Oh yes, yeah. One of the U.S. rules of engagement is we treat everybody equally. If you have a U.S. and an enemy soldier come in, you treated them all the same. I don't remember any specifics from this one, but in 2003 and 2004, we had 10 Afghani National Army soldiers come in that had been in a firefight someplace not too far from us. And the interesting thing back then was they took all these Afghanis from different parts of the country and they put them in the units. And sometimes they couldn't even speak to each other because the dialects from, predominant languages are Dari and Pashtun. Within those languages, there are different dialects. So some of the, and then we had a Pashtun translator. Some of the guys who spoke Dari, he couldn't talk to. So you'd have to get one of his buddies who wasn't seriously injured that spoke Pashtun and Dari to translate back. But some of them just couldn't even communicate within the same unit. But then we later found out the more severely injured of this whole group, we took to the OR, had been shot through the liver. And we took him to the OR, and we almost depleted our whole blood supply trying to save this guy's life. Finally, the doc said, I have no more blood that I can give him. We need to stop and, you know, put him. They brought him to the ICU where I was working, and all the other guys were in the other end of the tent, the other nine Afghanis, and they didn't know who this guy was. So then we determined he was one of the bad guys, but while they were scooping up all their injured, they scooped up the bad guy, sent him to us. Still, we, you know, didn't know at the time whether he was, but the hospital at Bagram was, that was their final stop, you know, before, I mean, for the U.S. soldiers, they'd go to Bagram and then on to Germany. Bagram, they stopped, and they always had, in each of the Afghani, or the Taliban that was in the hospital had to have a guard on them. And there were many days where we had more guards than patients in the, you know, I mean, they'd have two or three guards on depending on what their status was and how bad. But they would, when they went to the operating room, they got the same care. We used the same equipment on them. If you had a Taliban who was shot through the leg with an M16 or a 7.62 round and had a broken femur, he got the same external fixator to hold the bones together as the American guy in the next bed.
And when they were cured, they just became prisoners.
I'm sorry?
When they were better, they just became prisoners?
Yeah, they don't call them prisoners of war. What do they call them? Enemy combatants, because it's not officially a war. And because they don't belong to any army, they're not enemies or prisoners of war. They're enemy combatants. There are a number of prisons over there that are full with them, and they all have their own medical care. U.S. Army medics and Air Force medics staffing them, and Navy, but they get the same treatment as if they were in the U.S.
Did you ever have trouble getting adequate medical supplies?
This time around, no. We had a medical supply unit with us, and their headquarters was up in Bagram, so they did a great job of ordering for us. In 03 and 04, we had lots of difficulty getting, so that's one of the big improvements. At least we're getting medical supplies in, but blood, we could do an emergency 9-line was the system. We would just, you know, send a note up to Bagram that we needed blood in as soon as they could fly a helicopter. Now, sometimes because of weather, we weren't able to get helicopters into us. The Coast Bowl, as they call it, is like mountains three-quarters of the way around, and there's one pass through. If that pass was socked in with snow or rain, the helicopters couldn't fly through it. So there were a number of times we held patients longer than we would have because we couldn't get them through the pass. But we could call up to Bagram and order blood, and they would, you know, get that to us. Any other supplies usually took a couple days to order them, but blood was a big one that we could get right away. On August 28th last year, we got attacked by about 40, I think there were somewhere between 40 and 50 enemy combatants, whether they were Taliban, Al-Qaeda. A lot of them turned out to be, they weren't Afghanis, according to the Afghan army members who viewed the bodies after we got finished. But at 4:10 in the morning, I used to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning every morning to go run because it was the coolest part of the day. And at 4:10, I was just tying my sneakers and I heard a rocket. And I thought it was an outgoing round at first, because we had a couple of mortars and cannons that could launch rockets and projectiles long distances. And I thought it was one of our outgoing. And then I heard a couple more. And then I heard our M60 machine guns start firing rapidly. And I quickly knew that we were under attack. And it was the first big attack that I had experienced while we were there. And so I grabbed my body armor, put it on, and ran up to the hospital. The only ones in the hospital were the night shift. Everybody else stayed in there. The sleeping accommodations we had were hardened roofs, so they would withstand a 108 millimeter round. And that was the biggest that the Taliban or anybody over there was using against us. But they were built by Afghani contractors, so we hope they were up to standard. But the rockets started coming in, machine guns started firing. I ran up to the hospital. Shortly after getting up there, I got a call. We had two U.S. patients coming in, and they had been on the quick reaction force that went out to we had the hospital, then right here was the airfield. And on the other side of the airfield was where they were trying to breach our perimeter. Actually, two of them got through. And one young man up in a tower was firing at them with a machine gun and was cutting them down as they were trying to cut through the wire. They had AK-47s, they had RPGs, all of them had suicide vests and bolt cutters. And they were cutting the fence and coming through the fence. Two of them got through the fence. One, the machine gunner, killed about halfway across the... He got about halfway across the runway. The second guy got all the way... He shot him in the middle of the runway. He fell. He then got up. The guy started shooting back at the wire where there were still more people trying to come through. The guy got up from being shot in the middle of the runway, got to the second fence that got him to our perimeter road right that ran right in front of the hospital. The machine gunner saw that he had gotten up, turned around, fired at him again, and hit him, he said, probably 4 or 5 times. Saw him fall. He got up again and started cutting wire. They don't wear body armor. They don't wear helmets. In fact, they had on U.S. uniforms. The only thing that was different about their uniform from my uniform was he had sneakers on, a baseball cap, and a beard. So he got up to the next wire. The guy shot him 4 or 5 times. He fell. Guy went back to firing at the fence line where the other guys were still trying to come through. And the guy got up and started cutting through the fence again. Got through the second fence and on our road. Had he turned right, it would have taken him right to the dining hall where there was about 150, 200 people. Had he detonated his suicide vest, he'd have done some major damage. Had he turned left, the road would have brought him right up to the hospital. By that time, I had our hospital security forces out around the hospital, so I don't think he would have gotten too far. But fortunately, one of the first sergeants driving around in a vehicle recognized that his uniform wasn't right, stopped him, stopped by him, got out, and all he had was a 9mm pistol. Fired it 15 times into his chest before he fell down and died. When they took the suicide vests off them and they, searched them for any kind of intelligence, one thing they found in common with all of them was they had a little card with a prayer on it. And it said, say that, and we had the translators translate them for us, and something to the effect of, say this prayer 10 times and you will be invisible to the infidels. They cannot see you. They cannot kill you. And this guy, the first sergeant that shot him, was looking, said the guy was staring at him like, what are you doing? You can't shoot me. Just had this incredulous look on his face like, I can't believe you're shooting at me because you can't see me. They believed it. And they were all hyped up on probably a narcotic. They grow poppies over there. Everybody chews leaves with opium flavor or opium spiked. So, quick, bail me out with some questions. Yes.
Translators, is there better language preparedness, do you think, in your second time?
Yes. We all had to take a basic Pashtun class. Once I got over there, then they made us take a Dari class. And everybody gets a course before you go, before you leave. The second time, I also found we had better interpreters. Many of them are Afghanis who have moved to the United States, and now there's there are civilian companies that do nothing but contract with Pashtun or Dari speaking Americans, and they go over as civilians. They get paid really well, but they're put in some really horrendous situations. They're out with the U.S. guys knocking down doors and searching villages, and they're the first ones going in. Even though they're not armed, they've got to go in and make the announcement. And
Originally, like, born in Afghanistan and immigrated here.
Yes.
And then decided
In the 70s and 80s, there were several that I talked to that had immigrated to the United States in the 70s and 80s when the Russians were there. And because their families were wealthy, they were able to come over here. And for some reason, a lot of them were from out California way, where there's a large Afghani community, and they were all going back. They all wanted to see better things for their country. And so they were, and the pay is really good for them, so they would go over as interpreters. One of the things we found was that they hired a lot of local interpreters, and as much as they screened them and did security background checks on them, we had one interpreter that was working in the hospital. At every time we'd get Afghani patients in, we noticed he'd be on his cell phone. As soon as he was done doing his interpreting part, he would run out the door and he'd get on a call. And so we queued in our intelligence people, and a couple of weeks later, they called him down to the security office and they removed his badge. They did a cell phone scan on him. And in order for the interpreters to have a cell phone, they had to have a special security clearance. And so it was, you know, but they scanned this guy's, they were able to check his record and found he had over 150 contacts with known bad guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have a lot of control when, I mean, that's information and you can choose one word or another word or...
And one of the things we found a lot of times was, you know, you wondered about the quality of the interpretation that you were getting from the local interpreters, because you would ask them a question, they would ask it of the family member, they would, you know, go through this whole long chatter, and we'd get a one-word answer back from the interpreter.
Right.
And wait, he just said a whole lot more than that, so tell me what he said. And
did you pick up some language while you were there?
I did, but I couldn't tell you any of it right now.
Yeah. When you're around it.
Yeah, around it, I could pick up a few little words here and there. And they taught us a bunch of phrases that, you know, but once you get away from it, it's...
Yeah, it slips away. I have another question, if that's okay. Where do wealthy Afghanis get their health care?
Pakistan? There are a few Afghani national hospitals in major cities like Kabul and Kandahar. There was a children's hospital in Kandahar and one in Kabul. But we frequently had difficulty transferring our patients up there. They would say they just weren't prepared to take somebody with that severe injury. There were a couple of, but the outlying provinces had very poor medical. And, you know, one good thing is all the hospitals now, we had a program at Coast where we would take Afghani National Army doctors and nurses and put them to work with our docs. So they would come up and they would stay in the hospital with us for 6 weeks, get intensive hands-on training with our docs and nurses, and then they would go back to work in the Afghani hospital. That was only two at a time. Bagram had a program at Craig Joint Theater Hospital where they would have six or eight docs at a time come in, and they worked, depending on their specialty, with the U.S. docs and get a whole lot better training. But 6 or 8 weeks doesn't the doctor make.
Does anybody else have questions?
You think we're going to be there forever, or did you see any progress before you went back?
How many soldiers do we still have in Germany, Japan, Korea? And I think with the money I've seen going into infrastructure and bases in Afghanistan, you know, they may do a drawdown of the 100,000 that they put in, but I can see a long term U.S. presence there. And one of the things, very few, and I don't know what the numbers are, but if you saw the number of U.S. contractors over there and third country nationals, Filipino contractors and Koreans, and that, you know, there are probably almost as many civilian contractors working over there that are drawing a paycheck, probably most of them from the U.S., to build U.S. bases and to clean the toilets and to prepare the meals. It's all done with civilian labor, and a lot of it is from people here that have been unemployed and, you know, say, okay, I'll go live over there for a year. And you know, the dining facility workers were making over $100,000 a year to go over there.
Oh, my God.
Do
you know if anything's being done to go ahead and improve the health benefits of those that are severely brain traumatized?
All kinds of programs. I worked with that before I went over last year. I worked. I've actually been on active duty for the last 5 years, and I did the first year and a half at Walter Reed, taking care of soldiers there, and then I went to the Office of the Chief of the Army Reserve. They just revamped the Disability Evaluation System pilot program. They had the same system in place since World War II, and it took forever for a soldier to get his disability rating and get treatment from the VA. But prior to going over, and as far as traumatic brain injury, there's been all kinds of research and money thrown at it to, and the VA is doing wonderful things with it. But before going over, they gave us all a test, and I can't remember what it was called. We had to sit down at the computer and do a test to obtain a baseline, and then if you had any kind of head injury or were near any kind of explosion when you came back, you had to do the test again. Or sometimes, now they've actually started doing it right in theater. We have to identify shapes or, you know, match the number sequence. And there's a whole series of things on this computerized test that takes about 20 minutes to do. But they're now doing it in theater. If somebody gets injured, they would have them do the test, and then they can determine if they're able to go back to duty, and or if they've got to come back here for further treatment and care. One of the things, and I'm glad you asked it because it reminded me, one of the groups we worked with a lot was the guys that came in with the traumatic brain injuries, and or you know, MTBI, or it's a concussion. But there's guys over there, engineers, who drive around in these trucks all day long, and their sole job is to find the IEDs. Now, many of the trucks have been equipped with ground-penetrating radar, or they're like big graders, and they put a radar unit out in front of the grader, and you know, and they're all designed that if they hit a bomb, they're designed to break away in different pieces, so you know, the truck will go a certain way. And to minimize the injury, and they're all reinforced underneath and all kinds of, but these guys drive around all day, and their sole mission is to find bombs. And I got to talk with a lot of them, and I'd say to them, you know, how do you tell your mom that what you're doing over here is just drive around in a truck all day and look for bombs? Oh, my mom thinks I'm building bases in a nice, safe, remote place someplace, you know, or main base someplace where, you know, I'm safe, and she doesn't know I'm out driving around looking for bombs. And, you know, we're the best trained, best equipped military force in the world, but we also have the best people. Our guys, they don't want to leave their buddies. If they get hurt, the first thing they say is, I want to go back with my guys. We had guys who they'd come in with a concussion, and they'd have to be down for 3 or 4 days, and then they get tested again, and if they pass the test, they could go back to work. If they didn't pass, then they had to be down for a week. There's guidelines on how long they have to be down when they've had a brain injury. And we had one guy that was a medic, and he had his fourth TBI, fourth truck blown up under him, and we couldn't get him back to the little FOB he was at. He was some remote little place, and the helicopters weren't flying, and so he spent about 10 days with us instead of 4 or 5. And because he was a medic, every time we had traumas come in, he would come in and help us out, and he wanted to learn, and he's probably 21, 22 years old, and he got to go into the operating room with our docs and see surgeries and help with surgeries, and so he was learning a lot, and finally he got to go back. And about a week or two later, we got a call one day. There was a helicopter coming in with two severely injured guys from a road crew. They were searching for IEDs, and they had hit an IED. And the first helicopter had two critically injured on it, and the second helicopter had two killed in action. We unloaded the two critically injured, and they went into the trauma bay. I went back out. The medic on the helicopter said, I need some body bags and some help to get these guys. I didn't have any body bags on here, so I got body bags, and I climbed up into the back of the helicopter. And we laid a body bag out, and I bent down to pick this guy up, and I saw his patch that showed what unit he was with. I said, wow, I know guys from this unit. And I saw his rank, and he had something covering up his name tape. But as I picked him up and it fell aside, I could see his name tape, and it was the kid, that the medic that had spent 4 days with us, or, you know, 10 days. And he was unrecognizable. The devastation of the bomb, one leg completely gone, the other half, jaw over here, just had not recognized him, but I knew him like my brother, you know, in the short time I got to know him. And those were the tough days. You know, we had a kid over there, a U.S. soldier, that got pinned between two trucks, total accident. Truck got stuck. They were trying to pull it out. And they were trying to pull it out with another truck. Trucks rolled together, crushed him in between. By the time he got to us, he was dead. One of the guys with us was from Watertown. This kid grew up 3 miles from him. Didn't know him, but knew his dad. One of the guys that was with us knew his dad. And of course, we didn't know until a couple days later when they published the names in the paper in their hometown. And this guy came to me, he says, Top, I know that guy's dad. And so there was a lot of, you know, hitting close to home. I've taken up.
Well,
I could talk all night, so.
And I think we could listen all night. But in the interest of some people who might have an earlier bedtime.
Yeah. Talking to me?
I think we're going to make a shift to the next thing, which is Robert.
Robert.
But first I want to say thank you very, very much. And I have a feeling that they may want to talk to you some more at the radio station at another time. Yeah. I think they would really appreciate it. But thank you very, very much
for
coming out on a
me.
Hot day. Yeah. And I think it doesn't matter the size of the crowd. It matters how much they were intently listening.
You guys
listening.
Have been great. Attentive crowd, everybody listens.
Thank you.
Thanks.
All right, I'm going to try to make this stop.
You can just leave it up, Rob.